Welcome back to Equal Time. I'm Carl Etner. I'm broadcasting live from the Davis Center at the University of Vermont, where the Council on the Future of Vermont is holding a forum on the future of Vermont. And they're talking about their report, Imagining Vermont Values and Vision for the Future. And I'm not going to talk a whole lot about what's happening here at the conference today, because I think Mark Johnson probably covered that pretty well from 9 to 11. But we've got so many interesting guests here that it was easy to find a couple of guests to talk about their work. And in the second half of this show, we're going to be talking with Brent Bjerkman. He is the executive director of the Vermont Folklife Center in Middlebury, and it's 25 years old this year. He's relatively new in the position of executive director, although it has been over a year and a half now. Part of his training in documenting folk life involved a year in Sweden. His name, Bjerkman, is Swedish. It means birch man. And I used to live in Sweden, too, so Brent and I talked about conducting part of this discussion in Swedish, but Ken Squire put his foot down, and he said, no Swedish on my radio station. This is not the Muppet Show. So we'll do this in English, which is probably better for it. But before we jump into talking about the work of the Folklife Center and this fascinating new photography exhibit about the early Back to the Landers here in Vermont, I want to read a little bit from the report that we're discussing here at the Davis Center today, Imagining Vermont, which you can download. It's an easy read. You can spend an hour with the first two sections of it and learn a lot about the current thinking of Vermonters about Vermont. You can download it at www.futureofvermont.org. That's spelled out Vermont, futureofvermont.org. And this is what they say in the beginning on Vermont culture, just a little excerpt of what the report says. Vermonters have a strong sense of identification with the state, yet often hold to one or two very distinct senses of their personal identity. Citizens often classify themselves as Vermonters or newcomers. In every single forum across the state, the council heard from residents who would begin, I've only lived in Vermont for 27 years, but, and so on. Today, there are more Vermonters who were born elsewhere than were born here. Bernie Sanders spoke this morning and pointed out that he was one of them. At the same time, the council often heard participants in public forums blame newcomers for many challenges confronting the state, such as increasing cost of living, changing regulations, higher taxes, and patterns of land use and development. There's a delicate balance in Vermont between heritage and progress, especially in small towns. In some cases, differences based on wealth or time in the community divide residents and undermine the benefits that could come from all residents contributing their best talents and resources for the well-being of their communities. So Brent Bjerkman, executive director of the Vermont Folklife Center, I imagine when Helen and Scott Nearing and other early Back to the Landers moved here, they found similar tensions between native-born Vermonters and people from out of state.
Well, certainly they did. And that's really illustrated in our new exhibit that we're opening up. We have a new location. About a year and a half, we've been in this new building in downtown Middlebury, and we have a new gallery space. Actually, it's called the Vision and Voice Documentary Workspace. The newest exhibit that opened on Friday, exciting, and I hope you can get to it. It's going to run through September 5th, so people will have a chance this summer to come to it. And it's entitled Almost Utopia, In Search of the Good Life in Mid-Century America. And it really pairs the photographs of a woman named Rebecca Lebkoff. She moved to that area where Scott and Helen were starting this. Well, it was, in a sense, they were trying to find a utopian society with people that had these ideas, like-minded ideas of sustainability, humanitarianism, vegetarianism to an extent.
That was a radical idea back then, wasn't it?
I think to an extent it was, and he was quite a person. Both he and his wife wrote the book together, Living the Good Life, and it was really kind of the Bible for people that were going back to the land and were thinking about self-sustaining lifestyles and that sort of thing. So in throughout the 40s and into 50-51, before they actually moved to Maine, they lived in Jamaica, Vermont, in the Pikes Falls area. And the photographer that took these images, Rebecca Lebkoff, she's 94. She wasn't at the opening, but these wonderful pieces were from the summer and fall that first year she and her husband moved there. So it's images of both Helen and Scott and their friends, the Knaves, the Williamses, and then also some of the local residents that were there beforehand. And what we did is, what makes it unique is we're showing those, but along with that, we've went out in the last few months and interviewed people who were the Nearing's intimates, who were involved in that self-sustaining lifestyle. And also, because it was a while ago, we certainly ended up and quite happily to interview some of the children that remembered and trying to, you know, think back on what their parent, what they, you know, postulated their parents were probably thinking or wanting from that time. So it's a, so you're able to hear the voices through headsets, see these images from 1950, and then there's text as well. One of the pieces of text is, my parents were hippies before hippies existed, something like that. So it was a real pre-counterculture in a sense, when you think about maybe the 60s and into the 70s and that sort of thing. And I thought when I came on, it's always been a topic that I've always wanted to cover, and I think this is a great historical way to get into this topic, and maybe we can go further on, because it dovetails with what we're talking about here today with the future of Vermont too. People are concerned with sustainability, energy conservation, and these are the things that were just paramount to what the Nearings and their friends were trying to do.
If you're just tuning in, we're talking with Brent Bjorkman. He's the executive director of the Vermont Folklife Center. If you'd like to give him a call and ask him something about the center or what was going on in the Pikes Falls area of Vermont with the Nearings and their associates in the 1950s, the local Waterbury number is 244-1777, or you can call us toll-free from just about anywhere, 877-291-8255. Well, I'm fascinated that you went out and interviewed the children of the people who had come back to the land in Vermont. Was there any sense, or did you get a sense of whether they understood at the time that their parents were doing something unusual, or is this just the way one grows up?
Well, I think certainly from a child's point of view, I think they've had this many years of reflection, too, so they've kind of processed it then. But I think for the most part, they probably, some were talking about watching their family slaughter the male bull, because then they could have some meat, and thinking about that whole process, and it was a very visceral process, but they thought nothing of it in making blood pudding and that sort of thing. And now they think back on it, and some of them really think maybe it was a unique way to grow up and very different and challenging in some ways. I mean, I think it wasn't for the, they really had some convictions, the parents and the Nearings, that wanted to live this lifestyle. You know, it was during that time of the Cold War, beginning of the Cold War, right after World War II, when tensions were high. And a lot of what we got from the interviews, and particularly, for instance, Norm Williams was talking about people really had to commit to come out here and live. We had to live a very simple life, and it wasn't always very easy, and to be, you know, away from the war-making machine, as he called it at the time. So.
Well, when I think of having to commit to come out here, I think of you know, roads shutting down in mud season. I think of blizzards and that keep people snowed in for periods of time. Explain more about how the war made people who came here have to be more committed.
Well, I think they were just committed to ideals of pacifism is what they're talking about, and just being away from the larger, you know, I think today we say, I want to live off the grid, maybe. Mm. And I think that they were the pre-grid folks, as they were really trying to get to this idea of what it means to be a community without all this media hype and mass media kind of collective going on.
Mm. So there were draft age men among them who did not go into the military? Is that?
Yes. There were, and I believe that Lowell Nave in World War II, he was a conscientious objector, so he had kept, you know, 5-6 years prior to that during the World War II. He actually spent some time in prison because of his convictions. But so they're really trying to get away from that whole, and they were just trying to start this whole utopian society. And I don't know if they were calling it utopian. Certainly there's elements that they were probably trying to go to, but utopia probably wasn't the exact word that many of them used on a day-to-day basis. Mm-hmm. But.
And what was it about Jamaica, Vermont that attracted them there?
I'm not exactly sure about that. I mean, I think it was the spot that the Nearings started to, you know, began going to. I'm not sure if it was the cheap source of land, but it was away from any major center of civilization, too.
Mm-hmm. this is an exhibit of photographs, primarily, although you mentioned the audio that you've collected. And
yes.
You said the photographer, Rebecca Lepkoff, 94 years old now, was not at the opening.
Right.
But you explained to me the other day that that's not because she was too frail to come up to Vermont for the opening.
No, she's 94, and she's maybe frail to an extent, but certainly not in her mental health wise. She's a very, very sharp person. She had to make a decision. I think she has an opening in Paris in a couple of weeks. So she said, Brent, I really can't be everywhere at once. But one of the things that we do along with our exhibits, you know, what we do when we're going out and doing oral interviews is to really to validate the human voice. And a lot of times what we really try to go is get to the stories that nobody really talks about. It was said one time that really folklore and ethnography is really giving voice to the 99.99% of the people that aren't in the history books. Mm-hmm. And that's where you can really learn a lot about your culture and community and a lot of things that we're talking about here today. So we want to make sure that we validate. And then before we preserve it in our archive, we have over 5,000 interviews over the last 25 years. We want to make sure before it goes in for researchers to possibly get hold of, we want to create something from it. So Rebecca will be here this summer when she and her husband come back to Brattleboro, as they do each year. And we'll create a program where she'll come and talk about her love of print photography. And we thought that some of the students, especially at Burlington City Arts, who are in love with print photography, could join us for maybe an afternoon workshop where she shares her 72 years of photography with us.
Yeah, that's amazing.
So
there's students who still know what print photography is?
I believe there are.
Okay.
Yeah, and I think it's almost becoming art photography now, but it's,
right.
You know, it's a beautiful medium, and I think it'll be a great discussion as we talk about the virtues of print and over maybe digital, and we can talk about the pros and cons of each.
Well, you can find out more about this exhibit, Almost Utopia, In Search of the Good Life in Mid-Century Vermont, at the website of the Vermont Folklife Center. Why don't you give that to us?
Yeah, it's www.vermontfolklifecenter.org, and that's all spelled out. Vermont is even spelled out, so it's vermontfolklifecenter.org.
And I first came in contact with this site, it was probably a couple of years ago. Anybody who gets into radio and wants to be in the business of going out and capturing people talking and then bring it back and play it on the air or archive it, they very quickly, in their search for good equipment to use in it, come to the Vermont Folklife Center's catalog of various microphones and recording devices that there are out there, with the pluses and minuses of each of them. That's quite a project that you guys have put together to make all that information available to people.
Yeah, well, I feel very fortunate to be there and to be heading up a real talented group of people, director of education, but also this archivist who put together, Andy Kolovos, has been with us for about 7-8 years, and he's put together a very nationally, even internationally known site site on our website that talks about what kinds of equipment that you can use. I don't think we talked about it in our pre-interview, but in the spring we have a series of workshops, day-long workshops, for people that are interested in maybe anything from collecting family stories, or maybe they're ahead of a local historical society and they see the virtue of getting some of these voices in their community down. Mm. They understand that there is a richness in the oral interview that you really can't get in a history book, or it's with teachers who really want to engage their students too. So this is a resource for them and for the wider population. That if you have a certain budget, it's digital recorders. We don't use tape recorders anymore. So now, as you know, I see a laptop in front of you. You know, you can record something digitally and just drag it and drop it, or record it right to your laptop. And then there's a number of microphone options too. So it's a wonderful resource for both scholars, educators in their classroom, or just the person that really wants to start to record their family and their community.
And these spring workshops, are there any of those left yet?
Well, they'll be, yes. Actually, I call them spring. They really start in January. They run January through April. A couple of the titles are Ethnography and Deep Listening Skills. One is Oral History for Oral Historians. Mm-hmm. One is Manipulating Digital Files. Mm-hmm. So if you're going to start digital recording, you can learn about digital recording. And then, of course, you need to be able to know how you manipulate them, how you put them in subfolders, and that sort of thing. So it's really, in the summertime, we're also going to be running a four-day video workshop, which some people, you know, we're really for the last 25 years, we've really been about audio and getting that voice out. So we are slowly getting into some video as people want to start recording their communities and using that medium as well.
And you plan to offer the other audio workshops again next year?
Yes.
So people can sign up for those then.
VermontFolkLifeCenter.org, and you can just go to workshops. Like you said, we're celebrating our 25th year. So soon we're going to have a year-long calendar out. It'll be a June through May of 2010, and we'll have all that information. But as soon as we can get that together, we will provide that for the people that want to take that day-long workshop and get accustomed to what the power of the oral interview is all about.
And I believe you mentioned a workshop for teachers as well. Is that correct, this summer?
Yeah, it's a wonderful thing. It goes on. It's fully subscribed this year. It's the Discovering Communities Summer Teacher Institute. And what it is, it's a week-long, a five-day piece where teachers talk about place-based education, which really means getting your students out into the community. I think it also dovetails right into what we're trying to do here on the Summit of the Future of Vermont, because we want to keep children, kids, students engaged in their community. So we don't have, sometimes we talk about it as brain drain or wanting to leave Vermont because you have a perceived, you don't really understand, it's kind of boring here. So when you get into the community and you learn these ethnographic deep listening, how to do these interviews, and teachers learn that for a number of days, and then they go out and do projects and do interviewing themselves with either digital audio, digital video, or digital photography, come back on laptops, create a project from it, from their week's worth of work, and then they go back. This is in the summer, and then in the fall they go and they do some workshops, or they do some lessons with their kids and get their kids integrated, because it's a wonderful thing to get kids connected through asking questions in their community. But it's also great because they're using digital media, and kids they really get into technology. They pick it up quickly. They can cut and paste and splice and intro in and intro out and move things around, and it's really amazing. So it's really kids creating knowledge rather than sitting and being passive people in the seats, reading maybe, or staying in the classroom. You get them out, and they become a productive educator themselves and take pride and ownership of community. So that's one of the most wonderful things. We're really concentrating in Addison County this year, so we're going to have time to go out and do half-day workshops to, say, Mount Abe in Bristol, something like that. So we're very excited to be doing that this year, and we're going to continue on too.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to Equal Time. I'm Carl Etnayer, and our guest right now is Brent Bjorkman. He's the executive director of the Vermont Folk Life Center in Middlebury. You can find out lots about them at the website, VermontFolkLifeCenter.org. That's everything all spelled out. So it sounds like you're hoping to retain more of these kids in Vermont once they graduate from high school. It's a problem that people talk about chronically here, by getting them more connected with their communities after they've interviewed some of the people in their communities.
Yeah, that's always been one of my thoughts as a folklorist going out, is when you get people really engaged in their communities, then the ownership piece comes. And I think there is that thought that flight will decrease. That's one of the things that we were talking as you were listening this morning too, is we want to keep education strong in this state, and we want to keep it strong in the right way. And one of the things that I see is this kind of method working much better than maybe teaching to the test of that sort of thing. I think getting kids out into their community and putting these kinds of tools in their hands enhances in a much deeper way their connection to where they are, their classroom. I think what you want to do is, and it doesn't matter if it's children or from a very young age to high school, if you can engage people in their local community, then they start from that base, and then they can learn national, state, and national, and even international. But I think understanding where you come from in this deep, visceral way with doing using these methods of deep listening and asking open-ended questions and being thoughtful in waiting for responses is key to a healthy life.
Do we have any evidence that any case studies, any statistics that this actually does work in keeping kids in their communities?
Well, I don't know if there's really any statistics, but we do have feedback from teachers from the past who have been implementing this type of research. We certainly have a lot of curriculum coordinators who we began working with in the Addison district. And they certainly, some of them have been to teachers' institutes before and know intimately about this and have seen it work. So they've kind of been the people that have helped us bang the drum when we really wanted to concentrate this year on Addison County. Mm-hmm. Again, we want to be able to just, up to a couple years ago when we were doing these, we had national people that were signing up for this. So people would spend a week up here and then they would go back to Louisiana or go back to Minnesota. And it was very hard to connect and see how they used that information in their classroom. So we're very excited this year to be doing it locally. And you've asked the question, do we have any kind of metrics on this? We will after this year. And we're and with our website too, we're going to be able to share some of these programs and some of these projects that these students and teachers are doing. So we'll be able to share those and you can really see the power yourself.
Hmm. Well, as regular listeners to this show know, I'm part of the Transition Town movement here in Vermont and Transition Town Montpelier. And two of the ingredients in a transition town are, one is honor your elders, and another is reskilling, learning the skills that people used to have before we had all this oil and machines to do things for us, that old people who are still alive still have and maybe dying to have somebody to pass them on to. I know that Elliot Wigington in the Foxfire experiments down in rural Georgia, I believe it was, has sent generations of his school kids out into the hills to learn and document skills from the elders of the community. How much have you done of that at the Folk Center?
Well, I think we've done a lot. I don't know if we've actually done it in Wigington's way, where we actually get a chapter on, but we certainly have some of that in our collection.
Hmm. Well, what resources would the Folk Life Center have to various transition town groups around the state who want to go out and document old skills that people have?
Well, we have, like I said, we have 5,000 interviews, thematic interviews.
I'm thinking in terms of training people to go out and do the interviews themselves.
Oh, certainly. Well, you know, they could really take advantage of attending our spring workshop series. We certainly, as a nonprofit organization, you know, creating revenue is always a big thing, and especially in times like today.
So we could commission you to do something.
That's right. I mean, groups have come to us and either asked us to do these interviews for them for a particular project, or we could come and teach, you know, this methodology and talk about, like on our website, what types of equipment you might want to use. You know, maybe a group like yours could buy one recorder and share it on a schedule and you know, start to brainstorm who you might want to interview if preserving those lost arts or those lost trades or those lost skills or something that you seem to think are very important, which they are. Mm-hmm. So we often do that as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, you were saying before we got on the air here that there's some parts of this this report that we've been talking about today on the future of Vermont that especially resonated with you. Did you want to share those with
us? Yeah, that would be great. Well, I was just listening, as were you, to Paul Costello and Sarah Waring giving us an overview about the introduction and some of the concluding pieces. Thousands of people were interviewed all over the state for this, and some of the conclusions they came to seem to dovetail into what we've been doing for 25 years and what I think folklore and folk life research, ethnographic research, and using those deep listening skills touch on. One of the things they said in their Imagining Vermont, the report on the council, was it promotes community. You were born here or you're considered a flatlander. We all, you know, in a sense, we all have our story to tell. With ethnography, you can tell everybody's story because everybody's story is worth telling. So that's one of the things that I thought of. Building Vermont unity, I think this dovetails right into that exactly. If you're telling everybody's story, even if it's a Lao musician, let's say, in Brattleboro, who next week or this Wednesday we're giving the Governor's Heritage Award to as a traditional artist. That person's story is as valid as maybe an old-time Yankee fiddler as well. So I think being able to tell many, many stories, being able to teach the techniques where people can go out and get stories and then share them in a classroom or maybe on a radio program is definitely going to build unity, because we see that difference and strength and difference have a lot of meaning. And then number three was celebrating diversity. So celebrating diversity is really what it's all about in its many forms.
Brent Bjerkman, Executive Director of the Vermont Folklife Center in Middlebury, thanks so much for joining us. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Carl.
And I know you have a breakout session to get to, so I appreciate your taking time from that. Take care. So I'm Carl Etner. You've been listening to Equal Time, broadcasting from the Davis Center. And there are thousands of stories that went into this report of the Council of the Future of Vermont that was a little bit of the background for our conversations today. Again, you can download that at www.futureofvermont.org. So that's it for today's Equal Time. Trevin's in tomorrow. Anthony Polina will be in on Wednesday and Thursday. Don't forget to check equaltimeradio.com for podcasts of the shows that both Trevin and I host. Jack Donovan produced the shows. Got some great shows, great guests coming up for you next Monday. We'll be talking to Remling, the author of Carve Your Own Road, about making your own career path, and a legislative wrap-up. Stay tuned for music with Jack Donovan. Thanks for tuning in.